Friday, time for another DC Signal to Noise and lots to talk about. Jim Wiesmeyer and Annalisa Laca. Of course, I'm John Harris, the news director for Farm Journal. Jim Wiesmeyer, Pro Farmers Policy Analyst, and Annalisa Laca, milk editor or editor for Farm Journal's Milk, and also a policy writer for agweb.com. And as we were all sitting in these same places last Friday, we thought the world would be a much different place today. We thought we were going to have probably a COVID deal before Congress decided to leave town. We expected to know Joe Biden's vice presidential pick. And Jim, I in particular thought that we weren't going to be seeing baseball anymore. So I guess the world's very different than where we thought it was going to be a week ago.
Well, I don't think we're seeing baseball as we like to see it. But yeah,
I haven't been seeing baseball this whole week, and I'm a little upset about it. So hopefully they are able to get the Cubs-Cards game off tonight.
Let's hope. They have some players out, boy. Yeah. And as far as, the others, on the vice president choice, Biden did not live up to his initial deadline of actually August 1. But it's going to get closer and closer to the Democratic virtual convention of, August 17th. So you would think sometime next week. And the two likely candidates, if they're smart money, and usually smart money is not smart money, is Kamala Harris and Susan Rice. Wild cards would be Elizabeth Warren and a person to be named, you know? So I think those are the top four.
Why do you think this is being pushed back again and again? Or do you think this is part of the strategy all along? They just wanted to create buzz.
I think so. He's personally interviewed the top candidates, he said, and that does take a while. And then other things crop up, like Representative Bass. Some things came out that they may got nervous about. And if they would have chosen her initially, then they had to retrench. I'm not saying that's what happened, but those are the things. But I think the closer you get to the convention, even if it's virtual, I think the better it is, because you go in with momentum then.
Yeah, and Ed, you bring up a good point, is that there is all, I mean, they play out these leaked names like it's really a leak, but it's intentional, because they want to see what the public reaction is, and it does bring additional vetting from the press in addition to the private vetting that's been done by the campaign.
Absolutely. They listen to signals too, John.
Yes.
So they want to cut out that noise. I get a survey every day from the Democratic Party who I would pick as vice president. So I would imagine other people are getting the same thing.
Who did you pick?
I didn't answer it.
Okay.
Because then I'll get even more emails.
So that's why we don't have an answer yet. Jim Wiesmeyer has not spoken, and they don't know what to do.
I figure if I answered, then they'll lop on even more emails. I will admit, I get 10 times more emails from the Democratic Party than I do from the White House. Yeah, on campaign issues. Yeah.
That's interesting. Well, Annalisa Laca, in most years, a vice presidential pick doesn't make a ticket. It can break a ticket, as we've seen. But this year is probably a little different, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I think it would be naive to say that all eyes are not on who Joe Biden chooses to run with, because, I think by all accounts, he's a one-term president. I also think being the oldest president to be inaugurated on Inauguration Day, should he win, the ability of his vice president to lead in his absence is critical. So I think that's, there's no question that people are paying maybe more attention to who he chooses to run with this year than most.
Yeah, Jim, this hadn't really hit me till I heard this on the news the other day, that Joe Biden would be older. Joe Biden going into the White House would be older than Ronald Reagan coming out of the White House. And granted, we were all a lot younger when Ronald Reagan was in the White House, but at the time seemed pretty old and pretty risky. And now,
well,
it amplified that age. Now again, longevity has lifelong longevity has increased dramatically since then as well.
Genes, and it's a testimony to the pharmaceutical industry.
Indeed. So we wait another week for that decision. Let's turn now to probably the other biggest news of the week, and that is we have seen some more ratcheting up against China. The president announcing action against TikTok, saying that it's going to be shut down in the U.S. unless they find a U.S. buyer. Of course, Microsoft is looking at buying TikTok. There's another Chinese company that's a subsidiary of Tencent. Which is a big Chinese company, and this is a subsidiary that handles electronic payments. Plus, now I guess some action against some sanctions against individuals in China. So, really stepping things up this week, Jim. What's the signal from this?
Well, one of ProFarmer's China watchers, when I put out emails and phone calls for their latest assessment before we went to press, I plucked out one, and one of them said, and all this is a quote, "I'm afraid the relationship will further deteriorate from the low point today, especially with Cabinet Secretary Azar's visit to Taiwan," he's going to visit them on Sunday, "and demands on TikTok and other Chinese tech companies." He said the talks between Lighthizer and his counterpart, Liu He, taking place in a few days could be pivotal. He said he hopes China will continue to be able to separate their trade needs from any reaction to the United States on all these escalating other issues. And if agriculture would become directly caught up in the sourcing relationship with China, to state the obvious, it would be a major, major negative for agriculture. And frankly, I think that that sums it up. As we've said before, both countries need their trade, especially in agriculture, you know, with each other. So let's hope we can divert this. But I'll tell you, it looks like a Cold War is turning frigid when almost every day, you know, again, you know, we get more sanctions. You saw the sanctions, 13 individuals this morning, you know, related to the Hong Kong situation.
Yeah, indeed. And Jim, is there a danger now that we're not only turning to technology, but turning to individual companies and targeting a high profile company like TikTok? Does that bring danger in opening the door for the Chinese to broaden the scope of what they're targeting in the U.S.?
Well, the fear is there that they could impact on Apple and other big companies here. And trust me, Apple sells a lot of products into China. And if you want to see the top of Apple's stock market, have that happen, John. So yes, there would be major implications. As we pointed out the last 2 weeks, China is deep in behind the scenes over the next week or so again, talking policy. They call it holiday, but no doubt this is a top consideration. I don't think it'll go far as breaking off, you know, diplomatic relations. Then you really have another ball game, John. Let's hope it doesn't go that far. But yes, they could really retaliate with big companies like Apple, et cetera. That would be a major kick in the stock market in the U.S.
Of course, China can play a longer game in this than the U.S. can right now with the election coming up November 3rd. So does China wait it out and see what happens with the election, or do you think they're going to be aggressive between now and the election?
Well, you know, the way it's going, they may determine that although Biden and the Democrats are very forceful against China as the Republicans are, they would take a different approach relative pounding Trump does. So they may want to wait in my judgment, because when Bob Lighthizer, U.S. trade rep, was asked by the House and Senate, Senate Finance Committee and House Ways and Means Committee following his June 17th appearance, they asked him to comment written comments to their questions. And when it came to China, phase one agreement, Lighthizer stated several times that the agreement on phase one is an annual agreement, so we won't know until late this year, really early in 2021, whether or not to assess definitely whether China lived up to those tonnages and value.
Of course, Annalisa, this just adds to the anxiety of U.S. farmers as they wait to see what happens. Again, we have fortunately continued to see commitments to U.S. ag purchases throughout this. It'll be interesting to see if those still pick up as expected going into fall harvest. But this does not, everything that's been going on now has does nothing to reduce the anxiety of the U.S. farmer.
No, this is shaping up to be a year where we're able to find more anxiety than hope almost every day. And I think, you know, this action that just this week by President Trump and even just, you know, late last night with TikTok, I think farmers would like to see the deal with China get worked out. And I think that they've been tolerant and supportive of President Trump and his relationship with China up to this point. But I think to your point, we really would like to see this phase one agreement be fulfilled and then to see what happens after that. And, you know, Jim, the other thing that I've been thinking about and haven't heard a lot of analysis on is if, you know, should President Trump shut down TikTok? Should he not find a U.S. buyer for it? Should Microsoft decide that that's not a good fit? What does that mean for his election? And what does that mean for, you know, support of people that are in that age demographic that we know he needs to be elected, that are TikTok users and are probably not going to be very happy about not getting to use the platform.
No, I've already talked to a couple and they're very unhappy, but it's unbelievable the information that you have to provide to TikTok to even get the app. So there is cause for concern, but it's the degree in which you do it. And, you know, from a political standpoint, what the Democrats want to do is pick off a few more in different sectors. They don't, like, for instance, the ag vote. They don't have to win the ag vote, but they want to get a larger market share than what they usually get. And in close elections of what we may see in the Midwest, a number of Midwest states, Iowa, Minnesota, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, that could tilt it. And the same thing we're seeing relative to China. Watch the Democrats try to make, you know, inroads as a result of what they, I know, will call draconian measures.
Well, and Jim, both sides, both the Trump campaign and the Biden campaign, are starting that that ag campaign in earnest in the coming week. Let's start with the Biden side. You've got Senator Debbie Stabenow kind of leading the charge for the Biden campaign on agriculture. What's going on?
Well, she held her ag roundtable earlier this week, and you knew where they were going to go relative to the trade angle. And they brought up, and they had a number of, you know, selected farmers. Whenever, trust me, I know Senator Stabenow, she would have vetted those farmers on that panel. Not that they were not heartfelt, you know, they were. But it was made clear that she wants trade policy that works for American farmers. And one of the Michigan crop farmer, I think his name was Tim Boring, he labeled the trade policies the number one priority for the next, you know, president. And he said, we've damaged our relationships around the world in the last few years, haven't been good for agriculture. And then Stabenow concluded that, you know, Trump's trade policy is chaos, loss of markets and loss of prices for farmers. I mean, there is, in a nutshell, is, you know, their message to the ag sector.
And what will they be doing in the coming weeks to amplify that message for the ag sector?
Keep repeating. Stabenow, especially. In the farm bill, I remember so many farm bills. She had her talking points, and she didn't divert one word that she kept repeating it. And so I fully expect them to hit hard on prices, chaos, and loss of markets, including China big time and other markets.
All right, on the other side of the aisle, Vice President Mike Pence is going to be making a trip to Des Moines in the coming week on Thursday to kick off the Trump Ag initiative for his reelection bid. What can we expect there?
Well, you would hope that President Trump would call in, so that's going to be interesting to see. If he doesn't, I think it's a lost opportunity. But it's really what Pence hears. because we well know on this podcast that the number one issue for agriculture in Iowa, especially in corn producers and soybeans, is the biofuels policy. And President Trump still hasn't heard or understands the lingering concern relative to the SRE waivers, the waivers for the RFS Renewable Fuel Standard mandate. And you would hope that, Vice President Pence hears that in a bellow, when he's there, and at least brings that back to President Trump if he doesn't, camp on in a virtual appearance.
So do you think they'll have their message cleaned up on that before the Des Moines appearance, or do you think it's going to take feedback when he's in Des Moines to get that message cleaned up?
Now, in a normal election year, and this is anything but normal America and a host of issues, you would have it cleared up and you would announce it shortly before that session begins, John, or leak it to individuals, to big ag players, Farm Journal, et cetera. And then you get the spirit of camaraderie, rah-rah on that. But we're not in normal times.
So you don't think they're going to have their message clear on renewable fuels before Vice President Trump goes to Des Moines?
I think if it would have been really pro-ethanol, Trump would have gone. That's myself.
Yeah, no, I would agree. I don't expect them to have that cleared up because I still don't think they fully understand what the issue is for corn growers. And they're still trying to find some magic bean that's going to appease both corn growers and the Texas oil industry.
Well, as I keep on, I've talked to White House sources on this one, and they keep on saying, if we've committed the EPA to have the mandate be at least 15 billion gallons, including any waivers, isn't that what the corn growers really want? And I would say to a degree, yes. However, they don't trust EPA to live up to that of 15 billion gallons. And we really won't know that commitment until well into 2021, where Trump may no longer be president. So there's the uncertainty, John.
Right. There's no regulation. There is no law that holds that 15 billion gallons. It's, at this point, it's just EPA's word. And agriculture has good reason not to take EPA at their word.
Yes. And we had, Farm Bureau official, Dale Moore on AgriTalk. And he had some interesting comments. He said, now, Farm Bureau has been supportive of the EPA Administrator Andrew Wheeler on a number of other issues, the WOTUS, the new definition of, waters of the U.S., on some chemical issues, et cetera. But yet he did divide on the question of ethanol and the RFS. And I know that the Democrats see an inroad here in Iowa. We've had Pam Johnson on most of the time on AgriTalk on Friday, and she wanted the ag advisors at the time to Senator Klobuchar, and she's made that vividly clear to the key Democrats, but they also know it. This is the holy grail of the U.S. corn industry right now is, corn-based ethanol, and they want a commitment and they want it to follow through.
Yeah, and I don't think the Democrats are hoping to get a lot of votes out of that, but I think they're hoping that they may convince a few people to stay home over the ethanol and ethanol issue.
Well, look, it could be a doubleheader win if they could defeat Trump in Iowa, and then it's more likely that could tilt, Senator Joni Ernst into losing her, very close reelection race in Iowa. So. It should not be a surprise that Pence is heading to Des Moines, Iowa next week.
Annalisa, what's your prediction? What do you see in this this visit by the vice president to Iowa next year to kick off the basically Ag for Trump campaign?
Well, it's no surprise that they're going to start in Iowa for all the reasons that you guys just talked about. And I think, from a farmer perspective, the EPA is not well known for their ability to tell the truth or to stick with any decision that they make. So I think, the administration will certainly wait for farmer feedback. To Jim's point, that's not a normal course of action, but I think they need as much help as they can get to make sure that they're aligned with what farmers are saying, what farmers want, because they need Iowa. And I think that that's, I think, you know, Vice President Pence going is to feel that out and find out what the direction should be. And I completely agree that if this were a 100% pro-ethanol announcement, that President Trump would do it himself.
Isn't it remarkable that at this point, an incumbent Republican president who has rolled back WERDA, among other things, would have this much angst about an appearance in Iowa this close to an election?
Well, is he a Republican?
Yeah. Well, we should never rule out a last minute change. Okay. I'm not predicting that. But, you know, you can put Pence out, it's going to go, and then maybe at the last minute, they finally focus on an issue, and then in comes Trump, because we know how fast he can turn around and get his plane there. Right. But I don't know his schedule for next Thursday and things like that. Maybe there was a schedule conflict, but I know that they could have always dealt around that. Absent that, it is surprising, John. Annalisa, you had something?
I just asked the question whether or not he's a Republican.
Well, by a lot of definitions, maybe not.
Populist. Yeah.
Populist.
I think that's part of, I'm not going to say it's a problem, right? But I think he does not, he is not a traditional Republican. And I think it would be more surprising if he had views and actions that were more in line with a Republican of 10 years ago. I think it would be more surprising.
Well, in election politics, anger gets you to the polls more than anything else. And if this continues to go outside of what the ethanol industry wants, it'll bring more votes against him in Iowa.
Yeah, which is just, it's surprising because let's face it, a majority of voters, farm voters in Iowa, under usual circumstances, would not be voting for a Democratic candidate. I'm not saying all, I'm saying a majority. Yeah. And so it seems odd that a president would go in with that kind of uncertainty, largely just because of this one issue, because of the those refinery waivers.
So you wonder, although Trump ought to know it by now, okay, you wonder what advice he's getting on this issue, John and Annalisa, and who from. But I think if Pence does indeed
Ted
go,
Cruz.
It's Cruz, but he needs to serve as an offset. Pence from Indiana. He knows the score. You know when it comes to the Midwest voters. If he hears what we all know he should hear, he'll come back, and then it won't be long before Trump has to make another decision. But for EPA to keep postponing a final official announcement on the SREs, we had Reuters report that there could be some partial waivers. Well, you know, if it's partial waivers, that's still negative to the corn ethanol crowd. So we'll see what Pence brings back, and I want to hear what they tell him publicly and privately on this mm-hmm. and other issues.
John, to your question earlier about, you know, it being interesting that President Trump is worried about Iowa, I think we would be remiss not to note that it's not been an easy 4 years for any farmers, particularly corn farmers, and I think that always plays a role to some extent beyond the waivers and beyond all of the issues with ethanol, but it's just not been a great 4 years.
No, but you had clearly the downturn in working capital before Trump even became president. I mean, look at the chart on farm income. It was heading down at least the last 2 years of the Obama administration. And that's why I didn't cover today these stories on bankruptcies. To me, you should have an increase in bankruptcies in farm country when you're down 85% or more in working capital since the peak in 2012. I think the story would be if you have a significant decrease in bankruptcies with the financial situation out there now.
Yeah, good point. Wrapping up the election conversation, we are seeing some signs, Jim, that in some of the latest polling that I don't know if the gap is narrowing a whole lot, but they are not. The gap is certainly not widening anymore between Trump and Pence, which is if you're in the Trump campaign some good reassuring news that at least you're not losing ground anymore.
That's exactly how what election year analysts tell me how to put it, John. You could almost be an analyst now.
Almost.
The hemorrhage has stopped. So now he has to start making inroads again. And, you know, ironically, it could be this, the beginning could be this Thursday appearance in Iowa to announce, hopefully, we still don't know what his second term would be like. And mm-hmm. It's unbelievable to me. He's got what, 88 days, 87 beginning tomorrow. That's still enough time to say, okay, these are the things I want to do. He needs to start doing that because the American public, if it's just a vote on him rather than the major differences between Trump and Joe Biden, then you'd have to tilt it to Biden, but it's still early.
Well, and we've talked about this on the show many times, but neither candidate really has done much to define themselves or to define their opponent. Now, I would argue that Joe Biden doesn't need to do a whole lot at this point to define Donald Trump. I mean, I think most voters are aware of where that is. You just reinforce everyone's own the thoughts they already have in their heads about Donald Trump on either side. But we haven't really heard a whole lot from Joe Biden other than some plans rolling out, but there's been no public appearances really defining what he wants to do in a new presidency other than not be Donald Trump. And you haven't seen Donald Trump voice anything about what his vision is for a second term, nor have we seen, as we've said before, Donald Trump effectively define Joe Biden yet. Yeah. Although Joe Biden did Trump some favors this week with some gaffes that were... we've been waiting for from Joe Biden. You know they're there. You know they're going to come. And we saw a couple of doozies this week.
Yeah, he had to apologize for comments on racial diversity among blacks. And then he's had some other, miscues. And that's why you saw Trump, this week come out in pushing another debate, not just three, but an earlier debate in early September before all those millions of voters vote by mail. And I think it was a good suggestion, but it is not going to happen. Not enough time. And in fact, some people are putting out, but the Biden people say absolutely not. He's committed to three, I think the first one, September 29th, to, three debates. There are some people saying that he won't debate at all. And I think the American public wouldn't go along with that one.
No, I don't think so either. And I know the Trump campaign is counting on those gaffes, but I don't know I don't know that I would be that confident that my own candidate wouldn't be making equal gaffes in that head-to-head debate.
If they get, and who's going to be the questioners? I've always tell people that's important because if there's very few unbalanced or I want to say fair, journalists in the major media now, there really are not. And so it depends what questions, and it's easy to goad Trump to get off on tangents. And that's what they're going to do. And you saw Biden do that this week when he said he was goaded relative for taking a test on his
cognitive test. Yeah.
And he went ballistic, and used his favorite phrase, "Come on, man." And boy, he got guttural in his response. So that's what any debate you're schooled on trying to do is to get their goat. And it's easy. Trump's got a flock of goats. Okay.
Well, he does have a flock of goats, but, and I would agree that does not serve the country well, but at the same time, you've got a couple of candidates and I'd say probably Trump worse than Biden. That are prone to not answer a question and try to go off on tangents and lose the thread of thought of the original question more so than anybody ever has in politics. And so it is going to take a certain degree of pushback on the whoever is moderator of these debates to actually get answers.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And if you were diagramming, I'm from the old school where you diagram sentences, because I think that makes you,
Impossible for either one of those two.
I love those. But Biden has a lot of misplaced modifiers.
Yes. and Trump has no periods in his sentences.
No, it just goes on and on.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. So whoever it is will be challenged. I do think it's interesting that Trump put out that list of moderators that he would accept. And I do think there are some very good choices on the list. There's some very obviously biased choices on that list too, but I think there were some very good choices, and it almost concerns me because I think now, well, you can't choose those people because Trump has said he wants them.
Yeah. Well, and this is a fault that maybe Biden will fall into. He won't be geared to answering hard questions where Trump has had them for almost 4 years, whether or not he's answered them legitimately or not. But Biden is not used to having the usual ferociousness of the political reporters asking him questions. He has indeed been babied in almost every one of his interviews. And when the CBS reporter, in this case, what we talked about previously, asked him that question, he took off on that on that reporter.
Well, I think that's a good point. And I would argue that Trump has largely sought out friendly news sites and news outlets to be interviewed by, with the exception of a couple of really critical ones in the last couple of weeks. That's Chris Wallace and Jonathan Swan. And those were very good prep for a presidential debate. And you're right, Joe Biden has not faced anywhere near that kind of scrutiny up to this point.
No, and both of those that you mentioned, most would say privately they're Democratic tilted. But that's good as far as getting ready for those debates.
Yeah, indeed. All right, let's hit a few other topics here. You want to talk about the CEO of Great Plains. His name is escaping me at the moment. But he had an interview with Bloomberg.
Todd Becker, CEO.
Todd Becker. Talked with Bloomberg about the future of the ethanol industry and how he is really not looking at the administration for any further support for that industry.
You know, each week, if I don't write it, the story, I'll usually grade other reports or interviews I've read and score them. And the interview with Bloomberg scored the highest I've had in months, because he said some very interesting things that some of what are near and dear to my heart. He said, he told Bloomberg in the interview, I don't ever want to be dependent on government policy again. You know, that's relative to the RFS. He said he's disappointed that the industry's lack of discipline, flooding the market with ethanol every time margins increase. Sounds like crude oil there. And mm-hmm. as a result, he said his company, Great Plains Inc., left the Board of Growth Energy to invest their advocacy dollars to maximize shareholder returns. So that was a breath of fresh air to me, because he said his company's willing to spend $500 million transforming their company where they're not totally conditioned on the RFS. So I think this is the beginning of a heartfelt debate within the ethanol and biofuels industry that is needed, John.
But how can the ethanol industry survive without the RFS? Because they depend on the petroleum industry for market access.
Well, he got into, I can only say what he said his companies, he said cleanliness is now part of our DNA. So they've converted two of their plants to those products to clean your hands, et cetera. And he was asked in the interview, is that just a short-term phenomenon? And that's when he said cleanliness is now part of our DNA. And he's probably right.
Yeah.
And on the protein side, he knows that the byproducts are still very good products in the feed industry. For the ethanol byproducts and exports. So you may not have the number of players in the future, but he's gearing up right now. And I think that's going to hold that firm in good stead of what they're doing to get economies of scale and not just ethanol as fuel.
Well, Annalisa, I would imagine that if more in the ethanol industry took that approach, that would be welcome news to livestock producers who rely on those dry distillers grains.
Yeah, and right now DDGs are hard to come by and really expensive when you can get them. So I think any help we can get in that department would certainly help livestock producers.
Well, it'll be interesting to watch how he how that develops within Green Plains, and if they are able to decouple from the renewable fuels standard there and other government involvement in the ethanol industry. Let's turn to, I meant to hit this earlier, but the relationship with Canada, we're, you know, just weeks into the USMCA and already we're in a rift with Canada. Let's start with you, Annalisa. We knew this was going to come. I had no idea it was going to come this quickly, that U.S. dairy producers were going to complain about Canadian compliance under USMCA.
Yeah, so the U.S. dairy industry has been complaining about tariff rate quotas implemented by Canada since the middle of July. We first reported on it, I think, July 15th. But yeah, so this week, industry groups, the National Milk Producers Federation and the U.S. Dairy Export Council jointly sent a letter to the U.S. Trade Representative's office asking them to seek action against Canada to level the playing field and to, you know, enforce USMCA. Secretary Tom Vilsack has been very vocal about USMCA only working if enforcement, particularly for dairy, is held in full force, and they don't feel like that's happening right now. So yes, it was much quicker than what we expected it to be, but here we are already upset and already trying to take action against our neighbors to the north.
Yeah, well, and if that's too soon, but we go back to what I said when Lighthizer's comments and after his June 17th appearance, what he wrote: when it comes to dairy with Canada and labor or biotech issues with Mexico, he assured that USDR action under the USMCA, you know, provisions, quote, if necessary. So it's on his radar, but boy, you got to give this time to you know, be implemented, because what was it, July 1, mm-hmm. you know?
Yeah.
So yeah, I understand. Level the playing field. You know, I'd say there's no fans in the stands right now, as in baseball. You know, let's give it a minimum, I think, 3 months. Now, and if they do cite it, you know, so be it. Come after them.
And does that mean wait a little while before you say put on more aluminum tariffs?
Well, I've seen some noise, inaccurate comments by other people in the media, John, relative to Canada has said they're going to retaliate, what, on $3.6 billion of U.S. goods, like-kind goods. So that doesn't include potatoes from the U.S. That doesn't include ag products. That doesn't include dairy. And that'll come within 30 days. It's like-kind, aluminum or other similar products.
Well, since all the aluminum flow seems to be coming southward, I doubt there'll be much benefit from implementing aluminum tariffs on the U.S., so it'll be interesting to see what routes they take there.
Well, there was a political angle to this. It's called Pennsylvania. It's called Wisconsin and other states. And I don't think that it was a thing you should do, but we're into this silly season right now. But because Canada is a good ally, they don't do everything right. Neither does this great country. But it's just all politics on this one. That's the signal I got out of it. Here we go again, Mr. Tariff Man.
Indeed, sing me another verse. All right, let's wrap up with CFAP money. It is still not flowing out as rapidly as we thought. In fact, Farm Bureau and a few other groups are now asking for extension on CFAP application. That's the Coronavirus Food Assistance Program. What do we know about why this has not been paid out at the rate that USDA had anticipated?
Well, you know, we had Dale Moore from Farm Bureau on AgriTalk, and he gave some pretty good reasons. It's the structure of the program. It takes a lot longer. As you expand the group to other commodities USDA is not used to working with, and vice versa, those producers not used to working with, you know, farm service agencies or other agencies. I understand that, but my comments on the program was, I think this was a flawed program from the get-go. And I think you're seeing parts of this. USDA was over-optimistic in their estimate. Remember, this was just an estimate of how much they would spend, even though they're authorized to spend $16 billion. And trust me, agriculture likes to spend money. So that's what the frustration is. You know, I think More than a few corn and soybean producers had sold 2019 crop prior to the cutoff of ownership, January the 15th. I think that that's another reason that was not mentioned on AgriTalk. I just think it was they laid an egg of a program from the day that they announced it. So that's why I'm not in favor of extending this under the structure under a new aid program, John, that we haven't gotten into yet.
Yeah, and let's talk about that because here we are Friday afternoon. The Senate has gone home. As you pointed out to me before we started recording, they are still technically in session, even though they've left town. But no signs that they're even close between the Republicans and Democrats on a COVID aid package. So with everyone out of town, what happens now?
Well, how I'm reading this is that Trump always threatens, and he's threatened to issue executive orders under a number of areas of aid, some of which he can do legally, others of which both Democrats and especially Republicans question whether or not he has the authority to do so. So if he issues executive orders, then we could be in for a longer haul on this issue. If he doesn't, and they say late negotiations, because they're continuing to talk, are improving and things like that. Now, the Democrats say, just, come closer to our position, meet us in the middle. That signaled to me that they want at least a $2 trillion program, where the Republicans began with $1 trillion, and they're probably $1.5 trillion as we speak right now. So although these thorny, I think the biggest issue I keep on being told is the aid to states, once they can chew through that, this thing could still come together faster than what the headlines today are indicating.
What's your gut say, though, about Trump taking executive action tomorrow? Do you think that's actually going to happen?
If it is, it better be minimal of things that he can do. What both sides up on the Hill say he has authority to do. But if it's a multitude of things, I wouldn't do it. But, Trump likes to issue those EOs. So yes. We'll yeah. See. That's how I'm going to judge it. I'm going to judge it. If it's multitude, it'll just increase the obstinance on both sides. But if it's very selective, understand, then they'll continue to talk in good faith. But it's clear both parties want to spend more money, except about 20 GOP senators. They don't even want $1 trillion is what Mitch McConnell, the majority leader, keeps saying. Well, that doesn't mean this thing's dead. It just means you're going to have a lot more Democrats vote for it when it comes to the Senate, of which they will if it's $2 trillion or more, John.
Yeah, exactly. So we'll have to hold our breath. If Congress does not come through or takes longer than expected to come through with the plan, you've got a little over $8 billion in unspent CFET money sitting at USDA plus $14 billion in CCC. How much leeway does Secretary Perdue have in sending out that money as relief under new guidelines, not necessarily the current guidelines for CFET?
Well, he's got flexibility. There's no doubt about it. It's called the Commodity Credit Corporation Charter Act. But let's go back to other provisions that the Trump administration used. Language authorizing funding from the Treasury Department. That might be a whole nother CCC type of funding. They never did elaborate where that money was coming from within Treasury. Bottom line, they have the funding, John, to do what I think that they need to do.
That's interesting. So we do have a little safety net in agriculture if Congress fails to get anything moving.
Absolutely. Now, where the groups that should be concerned is the ethanol industry, where it already was beginning to look more negative of this week because of what Senator Grassley from Iowa said could be a skinny bill if they just agree on the big stuff, and the indemnity payments, because Secretary Perdue from USDA keeps saying he wants language authorizing him to do so. Maybe they can squeeze that in. So it's not open-ended on the part of agriculture. We still have those two thorny issues that need language to authorize. But when it comes to the main crops and livestock, they've got portions of the $14 billion to work with. Remember, other payments, the CRP payments, the ARC PLC payments come out of the CCC as well.
All right. So we'll have to watch. Yes, Annalisa.
I was just going to say, but can't you just see Congress not getting CFAP done, President Trump being like, listen, Congress can't get their act together, but I'm for the farmers, so here's some money. Like, that, he would totally do that.
Well, yeah, Eddie's got the purse to do it, as we just discussed there. So, yeah. I think that's totally.
That. Well, he did it for MFP1 and MFP2. Exactly.
And if this doesn't come together sooner rather than later, I think he's more and more likely as the election day approaches to do that.
Yep.
Yes, but and Americans will see for sure we're down to 1% worth of Congress and the administration, you know, working together. That it's ended until November the 3rd, because if they can't, with the express need out there in America, and you saw the jobs growth, you know, non-farm payrolls were up 1.8 million in July, above expectations, by the way, but it was down from the record 4.8 million gain in June, and unemployment rate was cut to what, 10.2,
yeah,
11.1 in June. So you know, you can read what you want into it, but that still says almost 13 million people unemployed relative to what we had in February. So the need is there. And that's why I think privately the Republicans, at least the negotiators, are coming not close to, but closer to the, Democratic amount of, money that they have vast differences on where it goes.
Yeah, and I think we already have an angry electorate. I think that would only amplify that anger greatly if we went into November without any additional assistance. Up to this point, that anger seems to have been benefiting the Democrats over the Republicans, but I don't know that you can necessarily count on that through November. But I think the degree of that anger only increases the uncertainty of this election.
Well, and then that brings you to, I know we're running on deadline here almost, to the COVID thing. Have we seen the peak in the number of new cases again? We're starting to get signals of that. But I'll tell you what my doctor told me. He said, I can do what I want, but he cautioned me to not go out at all because of my age and the inability of way too many young people to socially distance correctly and to wear a mask. And when I go to the supermarket elsewhere, I will not go in, John, if I see people going in without a mask. So, I mean, this thing could increase again if the younger people who may not get over, in most cases, I don't want to be, I'm not on Facebook, so I don't have to worry. I won't say the young people can't get it, okay? But it's lesser odds, and if they do get it, they don't have the implications that people of my age and elsewhere have. So we're not out of the woods yet on the COVID angle, and so this could come back to bite Trump still, because that's what the Democrats are going to hammer on.
Indeed. All right. Well, let's wrap it up as we always do. Where are you going to be watching for Signal this next week, Jim?
Oh, my goodness. The China's reaction to what we saw announced today and earlier this week. Two is Canada's official response to the aluminum tariffs. And next week on Wednesday, we get the first USDA crop survey estimates from for the major crops, corn and soybeans in particular. And it looks like a growing number of people are projecting above trend yields for both of those crops.
Yeah, all of the major predictions have been growing that crop well over last year. So it'll be interesting to see what USDA has to say on Wednesday. Annalisa.
Jim Stolman, I'm also watching the yield survey next week, but also, dairy markets have relatively reversed. So class three markets, some contracts later this year are trading below $17 again. So watching to see what happens there and what any additional CFAP program, whether that be government purchases of cheese again or what that might be, what those do to the market in the next couple of weeks.
All right. Well, as always, been a great conversation to both of you. Jim Wiesmeyer, Pro Farmers Policy Analyst, Annalisa Laca from Farm Journal's Milk, and I'm John Harris, News Director for Farm Journal. Thanks for joining us on this week's edition of DC Signal to Noise.